Welcome, everyone, to episode number 114 of Underserved. Joining me today in studio is Jason Mack McCauley, a technology leader in the Boston area. Let's get started.
Welcome to this week's edition of Underserved, the podcast for the rest of the tech industry, where we focus on stories of tech industry leaders, their insights, and their lessons learned. And now, your host, Andrew Jalina.
Mac, thank you so much for joining us today on Underserved.
Well, thanks for having me. Very excited to be here today.
So way back in the day when you were at a tender young age, you really weren't that into technology, were you?
Didn't really have access to it. You know, grew up not necessarily wealthy. Back in the 80s, having a computer in your house was a luxury item.
Were you in upstate New York?
Yes. I grew up in upstate New York. Well, I grew up until I was about 10 in Williamstown, Massachusetts, the very corner of the Berkshires up on the top there. And then my mother married a dairy farmer and we moved to upstate New York. I went to a 5-town consolidated high school and graduated with a class of 51. And the only computer in the entire building was the one that was in the library. And only the librarian was allowed to touch it.
Sounds about right. You went from rural to more rural. That's hard to do.
Yeah, that's very tough to do. It was always exciting to go back to Williamstown where there were actual humans around instead of just trees.
Now, were you in the service at all?
Yes, did 6 years in the Guard, so Army Infantry.
Hoo-ah. And after you got out of there, I imagine you might as well leverage that into a college education.
It was at the same time, actually, luckily. So I signed up for, you know, the military in order to pay for college because my stepfamily wasn't necessarily pro-college, so I had to find a way to pay for it. Yeah, the military was the way.
Where'd you go to college?
I went to North Adams State College, which is now known as Massachusetts College of Liberal Arts. They actually changed the name of the college. I think it was about 2 years after I graduated and got a fun little thing in the mail saying, you know, for $50, I can have my degree swapped to the new name. I declined.
Okay. And what were you studying up there in North Adams?
So my freshman year was undeclared and sort of casting about for what I wanted to do with my life. And I took philosophy 101 and fell in love. You know, out of 120 credits for a degree, I took 78 credits worth of philosophy, ran the college out of courses and just started building my own. So I did a bunch of independent studies as well around the ethics of punishment, one on anarchy, actually, and, you know, a few other sort of interesting areas that I wanted to dig into. It actually led to one of the more rewarding things that I've ever been paid to do. After I graduated, one of my friends, a professor, had to have heart surgery and asked me to come and teach his 100-level philosophy classes for him.
What was the idea with the end game? Were you going to become a professor or...
That was 100% the end game. All I ever wanted to be was a philosophy professor, just settling down into academia, writing books, and teaching. It's interesting because the beginning part of my career was me really trying to hit a second startup so that I could retire, go back, get my PhD, and teach philosophy. Engineering wasn't even the goal once I was an engineer.
So you get out of school, you get your first job. Was that at a place called Tripod?
Well, so I had a couple of things before that, just a couple of small things. The thing that really built confidence for me in the computer space. So while I was in college, my girlfriend, who became my first wife, bought a computer. And they just made complete sense to me, right? They only do what you tell them to do, and you can't break them, you know, in any way that you can't fix. So I wound up, after graduating, taking a job, a company called Sports Marketing Incorporated, which was this little 7-person firm in Pittsfield, Massachusetts, that promoted and produced the international tour of the Moscow State Ballet. Now, the Natalia Sots, not the Bolshoi. So it's basically the state ballet that was down the street from the Bolshoi, but promoted and produced, did a bunch of graphics design and stuff like that for the posters, and then got let go when the tour ended. And then I wound up at Tripod.
Okay. And what were you doing there?
So I came in as a membership assistant. The funny part of the story is that Toon Pham, the guy who hired me, asked me the wrong question. He asked me if I'd ever built a web page. Now, back then, this is before he had most of the visual editors out and things like that. So what he was really trying to ask me is if I knew HTML, which I didn't. But the night before, I had downloaded this new thing called Netscape Navigator Gold, which had one of the first visual editors for HTML pages in it. And I had banged one together. And so I could answer the question, yes. So I started my engineering career, essentially getting paid $18.5 to be an email-based tech support guy. Because I had a degree in philosophy with a concentration in ethics, I was handed the ability to determine what was and what wasn't acceptable speech inside of our homepage community. Tripod, I should say, was one of the first places on the web that allowed you to publish your own
own content. So we had a homepage builder and things of that nature. And so our mission was to democratize publishing and to eliminate the middleman that used to stand between what you wanted to say and anybody who wanted to hear it. These days, there's no barrier to getting what you want out there. And Tripod was one of the first places to allow you to do it.
Well, I got to imagine the old equation is UGC equals TNA. So what are folks posting on there?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's what I always joke. If you let 3 million people publish anything they want, they do. So, you know, a lot of what you would expect, people with adult interests, some folks with more Puritan interests, publishing things that were unnecessary. There were a lot of racism sort of being published as well. So back then, search engines were terrible. And since my job was to sort of cultivate that homepage community, I had to go out and find people who were offending the terms of service, which I actually had a hand in writing as well. And search engines back then were just terrible, right? They would take, you know, like a week to index a site. And by the time you try to use it for the first time, the indexes are all out of date and it's just terrible. But I noticed that the folks were using certain heuristics in their data when they had certain intentions for their site. And so I taught myself SQL to go directly after our Informix database in order to pull some of these suspects out. And then, of course, I'm somebody who just doesn't enjoy repetitive tasks. So I taught myself Perl with the help of my friend Nick, who I will credit with the rest of my career. I learned Perl in order to automate some of these things.
Did some work with Image Magic, too, to do the same thing, right?
Exactly. So basically, I wrote set of jobs that ran overnight. So you had the heuristics in the database, Image Magic to collect up percentage flesh tone in images, other things like the ratio of images to HTML pages. So they would collect some suspects overnight. And then in the morning, I had a little web-based interface that I wrote using frames, because it was the 90s, where I had the relevant decision-making factors in the main window. So I basically distilled all of the content out of the HTML pages and the list of suspects down one side, and then what I could do to them across the top. The one thing I could never figure out how to optimize out were parchment. So I would pull back historical document sites all the time when looking for, you know, folks with less educationally focused content.
Okay, so the parchment was a false positive for too much flesh tone.
Exactly. Okay. Too much flesh tone. Once I built that, they invited me to join the engineering team.
All right. And where do you go from there?
So from there, I spent about a year and a half actually still at Tripod in the engineering organization. That little tool, I had a friend describe it once as probably one of the world's first porn search engines. So I guess we should be clear about what this thing was picking up.
I'd say it's more like a porn radar detector.
Yes. There we go. Oh, so funny piece. After I built this, where my desk was at Tripod, my monitor actually faced the front door of the office. So, you know, you had investors coming through, all sorts of things. And there's my monitor.
Here's Mac moderating away like crazy.
Like crazy. Once we had this interface, we started generating a lot of these account deletion requests. And, you know, it was back in the day, low power databases. So the user account was spread over probably 35 or 40 different tables in this schema. And deleting one account would take a couple of minutes to get through all of the queries, doing all the deletes. So this was causing a massive backup. So I wound up writing I thought it was kind of a cool application where I used forked processes. I forked processes on Solaris and then used bidirectional pipes to pass messages. So I basically had a place that took the request, set up an account disablement request into one pool of these forked processes. And then when that was done, it would set another message on a different pipe that would go to the cleanup process that could take as long as it wanted. It was kind of a neat thing to build something that now I know is a message-driven architecture, but back then it was just sort of, this might be a neat way to do it.
You are listening to the Underserved Podcast. Underserved is produced by Maris Consulting Group, embracing the power of people in technology. For more information, visit mariscg.com. That's MARISCG.com.
So the next few years, there's the kind of the dot-com boom and bust. What are you doing?
Yeah, sort of oscillating. As I said, you know, I fell into the technology completely by accident. I just fell into it sideways. My goal was still to try to hit a startup. So Tripod got sold to Lycos, but I was too low of a rank and too late in. I was employee number 30, but it was still too late in to really walk away with retirement money. So I went on to try to find different startups where I could land another one with enough equity so that I could retire, go back, get my PhD and teach philosophy. And so I did that for a few years. I oscillated between a startup trying to get in before the 10th employee and consulting firms more or less as a way of finding the next startup.
But what it did give me is the ability to do a lot of greenfield development and architecture. So I think I came up to speed very, very quickly and early in my career with a lot more architectural thinking, just because I got to learn from my mistakes at a higher rate of iteration than most junior engineers do.
So you do finally get in as employee number 6 at OMS. What are things like there?
So OMS was my last client when I was at CTI. I moved over there. We, you know, sold our application to EMC, spent the next, you know, year or so fitting it to EMC. You know, the problem with shooting an elephant like EMC as a startup is you've got to drag the elephant home. And so every penny that we took in from landing EMC, we spent almost immediately getting the application to work at EMC. We kind of scrambled after that. I grew that organization to 15 or so from an engineering point of view. Then after we got EMC landed, we didn't get sales fast enough. I had to let almost all of them go. You know, the folks of us who were still there, you know, had our salaries cut. So it became kind of an amusing thing because, you know, if you're going to pay us half, we'll work half. So in the morning, we'd bang a bunch of code, go out to lunch, come back from lunch, use the land as for an Unreal tournament, essentially in the afternoon. So we figured that was an equitable trade.
Now, around this time, you're having a kid and kind of thinking about the philosophy professorship. What are your thoughts then?
Yeah. So about 30, having a first kid, right? And when you have a child, your perspective on what your life is going to look like changes. It stops being about just you. I realized that I had a career that was going to allow me to support those who now depended upon me, and I should commit to that. But giving up on being a philosophy professor was very, very hard. It was sort of traumatic. And so it set me back into a mode of doing a lot of thinking. And when I'm in a rough spot, I tend to do a lot of reading. So I started reading a lot of existentialism, a bunch more Buddhism, some more Eastern philosophies, Taoism, and began to focus on where I was rather than where I wanted to be, and studied and drilled into what I loved about what I was doing on a day-to-day basis and committing to that. So from philosophy to engineering, the thing that makes engineering, I think, amusing to philosophers is that it's the same type of abstract thinking that you do in philosophy. It's about finding the right questions to answer to create the context for the code you're going to write. So you get to do the mental calisthenics that make philosophy exciting, all that abstract thinking. So the technology is fun, but the problem with tech is that you can solve the problem and it stays solved. What my brain was craving as a philosopher was an unsolvable problem, something that I can always find a better answer to. And people are two things. One, they are the ultimate unanswerable question. And two, they're always worth it. I will say that throughout my career, I've never spent time on someone that I thought was wasted. So you've got the rewarding, open-ended aspect of thing and beginning to focus on leadership philosophy and how to build cultures, how to build stronger sets of agreements and things of that nature. And that became the focus of my career, is teaching, mentoring, and growing folks in that realm of leadership philosophy.
You can't go on working half days and playing Unreal half days forever. So you move on to Molecular. What are things like there?
Molecular was interesting. So this was an end-to-end consulting firm, full service. So we had a strategy group who would talk to you about your business model and look for opportunities, do the end user studies, all of that type of stuff. We had user experience folks. Steve Mulder is one of the folks who was working there. He wrote an excellent book called Persona Driven Design, which, you know, has become kind of the standard in the market at this point. And we would build things end to end. So I was a senior consultant, so I would do a lot of the estimation around technical lifts for what the strategy group agreed to with the client. My last engagement there was with a company called MC Communications, and what they did was continuing medical education credits for doctors. In order to maintain their licensure, they have to take a certain amount of education on a yearly basis in order to keep their license up to date. So what we built was an application that took all of the content that they were doing at conferences and things of that nature and began to personalize and target that at actual physicians. So through quizzes and things of that nature, we could figure out where to target it. It's the place that I learned that you should never, ever shave an estimate. And it was this engagement that did it. I think I quoted it out originally, giving it to the sales guy somewhere around $4 million, which, of course, everybody chokes on, right? Nobody's going to buy a $4 million project. You better sharpen your pencil. So I went ahead and sharpened my pencil. I got it down to about $2.5 million. I think Molecular wound up breaking even on that gig because the cost of it actually came in to be about $4 million.
So I will never, ever shave my estimates again. From now on, it's if you want that price lower, you can shave your rates.
So this is like right before like financial crisis time, like 07, 08. You had a couple stints then?
Well, so Molecular, that ended with an interesting lesson actually as well, right? Because once it was underestimated, it became a death march to try to get it done. And so it was months and months and months of 6 days a week, 12, 13 hour days in order to try to drive this home. And it was destroying my personal life. And so I moved on. And I went to a company called Navimatic. And there it was interesting that I think it was the afternoon of my first day that I wound up in a meeting with a bunch of the senior management, a bunch of VPs, and they got into an argument with each other in front of a bunch of consultants who were in to try to build us a strategy around enterprise data management. And I didn't last very long there because at that point, it's like, oof, massively toxic culture. Probably the spot, if I'd sat down and I'd thought about it a little bit, could have been the spot that I should have dug in my heels and come to the realization that at a certain level in your career, it's your job to make it a place where you want to work. That was probably the first opportunity where I might have had that opportunity, but I didn't see it. I moved on from there to a company called HealthEdge. HealthEdge was interesting, claims processing, just like Navimatics, but they had their own claims processing engine that allowed you to model insurance contracts in just about human language, as opposed to what was currently in the marketplace, which was a lot of 2-3-digit codes in order to identify a procedure. Honestly, it's the sort of green on black screens, you know, lots of tabbing, all of that type of stuff. I was part of the professional services organization there doing a lot of migration. The problem is that this was before the ACA. So you still had things like lifetime caps, you had cutouts, you had all of these things that limited the liability on the part of the insurer, you know, with regard to medical history. And so in order to do a migration, you basically had to replay every patient's claim history in order to get to a point where you knew if they were hitting a lifetime cap, you could accurately service the claims that were coming in after. So to make matters worse, the insurance companies would change the codes every couple of years for the procedures. So code to the next code was never documented anywhere. It was like reading tea leaves to get these migrations done. And so that turned into just nights and weekends and nights and weekends and nights and weekends once again.
So that's going to make you move on. Where do you go after that?
So from there, I went to a company called Percussion, which was a content management firm. I actually knew them because I had recommended their content management system a couple of times while I was a consultant at Molecular. So I knew them, and I came in and I took over the professional services organization. And this is one of the first places where I really, really started to apply thoughtful philosophy of leadership and how you actually move things and get them to change. When I took over the organization, it was probably doing around $900,000 a year in consulting, and it was billing out these sort of small, fixed price, educationally focused packages to customers. The problem was the content management system that we were selling was very complex, which meant that once we're done with the education, we build you a couple of content models, and then we leave you there to struggle on your own. And undoubtedly, you become a very annoyed customer. So what I proposed and changed at Percussion was that we start to do full service engagement. Because looking at the way that we were selling at Molecular, particular getting on to sales that are outcomes focused rather than feature function tick box focused, right, seemed to have a lot more success. So started pitching consulting gigs with that goal in mind. So we landed a very large contract, multi-million dollar contract with the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. We had relationships inside of the Department of Health and Human Services, and we sold a very large multi-million dollar contract to the CDC. Long story short, over the course of, you know, about 3 years, I took them from that $900,000 to $4.8 million in consulting business, running it around a 40% margin, which I was awfully, awfully proud of.
You should be. That's not easy to do.
But the cool thing was the amount of talent that I got to develop there. You know, I was hiring folks directly out of school and then just building them and building them and building them. A couple of folks in particular, one gentleman named Ankit, got right out of Georgia Tech, came up and put him on some small gigs to begin with. And then, you know, within 2 years, right, he's running the CDC engagement for me and crushing it. Just building talent and seeing where they are today is actually just such a rewarding thing.
Hey, sport. How was school today?
It was okay, Dad. How was work?
Ugh, actually, I had a rough day. Leading an engineering team is hard. I mean, I have to ship new software, meet deadlines, and tackle new projects while keeping my team focused on the day-to-day. It's hard to keep up.
Jeepers, Dad. Why don't you call Maris? They're the staffing firm with the best technical resources around. They helped Billy's dad. He used to be stressed out like you. He was missing deadlines, his team was overworked, and a bunch of folks left the company because it was too stressful. But then he called Maris. And they put resources to work right away. He hit all his deadlines and freed up his team to do other work. His boss was so happy that Billy's dad got some extra time off.
Time off? Wow. What did he do with that?
He spent it with Billy.
Aww. That's a swell idea, son. I'll call Maris today. Now, you go wash up for supper.
You had another instance, too, with Alice in marketing.
So Alice, she had electrical engineering degree from Northwestern and was in the marketing department. Everybody used to hang out. It was a small company. It was less than 200 people, I'm sure. And Alice was miserable with what she was doing. So I asked her to just try a couple of the techie tasks, you know, that we had hanging around the edges that didn't necessarily need to be done, but they would be nice if they were done. And she smashed them. So I went to her boss and I said, hey, can I steal Alice? And sure enough, over she comes. And she starts just smashing engagement. She's just continuing to grow her. I think she's a director somewhere near Chicago now, which is just amazing.
Now, not everyone bought into the outcome-driven sales approach. So what happens?
So what is that? I think it was Westmoreland who used to make his lieutenants actually write their own obituaries when they came in country, right? So I kind of think about my career that same way. I'm going to give you my opinion because that's what you bought. If that gets lumped in with the first round of layoffs, then c'est la guerre.
So where do you go next?
So from Percussion, I went to a client, American Student Assistance. ASA was an interesting company in that they were a student loan guarantor. And the student loan model, the federally funded student loan model, used to be that you had a private bank, somebody like Bank of America or something like that. You had the guarantor, which managed the health of the loan. And then you had the federal government that basically provided the teeth to keep the student loan cycle, we'll air quote the healthy on this. When Obamacare, the ACA, went into effect, one of the things in it was to change the way that federal student loans were funded so that they come directly out of the U.S. Treasury now, which eliminates the need for the third-party lender and therefore eliminates the need for the student loan guarantor. Now, ASA was a nonprofit, but it had a book of consolidated student loan debt that, you know, was bringing in money hand over fist. So they decided to pivot and to do something altruistic, which was to provide a platform for giving educational content around student loans to parents and students so that they could more comfortably complete a student loan cycle. But here's a company that has spent its entire existence doing all of its business with snail mail and phones, and they want to go build a web application for the first time. They did all the predictable things. You know, you had an organization for everything. QA automation, front-end engineering, back-end engineering, services engineering, database engineering, infrastructure engineering, on and on and on and on.
Who was in charge of over-engineering?
Well, it's Matthew May who talks about addition through subtraction and the problem with doing aggregated process. My interpretation of what was going on at ASA was that they tried a thing, it didn't work, so they added another thing without taking away the first thing, and it just kept building. The other piece to acknowledge there, too, was that the architecture had all of these nasty circles in it. I never got to meet him, but I think the gentleman who architected it might have been his first or second go at it, and he must have recently gotten his hands on the Gang of Four book and took a read through it, said, this is awesome, I'll take two of each, please, and just found a place to put them.
Which, the dependency diagram that looks like a wreath?
Yes, exactly. Exactly. It looked like a fractal. So I set about solving two problems. One was the organizational issue, because you had so many different organizations rolling up into so many different people that communication just wasn't happening. Prioritization was an absolute nightmare. And then you had the architecture on the other side, which was so brittle that you couldn't even publish content to it without knocking it over dead. So we had to solve both of these at the same time. On the first end,
spent the next 18 months grinding that organization down and breaking down all those barriers until we had basically four or five independent scrum teams that were cross-functional. So it had everybody in there. Also, at the same time, converted all of the BAs into QA and all the QA basically into BA. So it was really a BA-QA role.
Exchange program.
Well, it wasn't even exchange. I just sort of eliminated the BA role and had QA play that role. Mm. The idea there was that if you're the ones writing the requirements and validating the requirements, we've got a closed loop. So once again, if we get down to this elegant process point of view, right, we're taking things out. While I was there, what I was primarily focused on was eliminating handshakes and communication. We've all played telephone in school. And by the time you get to the end of the chain, the message is completely modified. It's unrecognizable. Same thing works in business, right? Especially in engineering, where it's got to be very, very specific. And the specifics of the jargon of the jobs in the chain, the jargon is different for each link in the chain. So what I tried to do was to bookend it by someone who actually was using the same words because they were their own words. You close this telephone loop so that you actually get what the business was initially after. Breaking down all of the organizations so that we had these cross-functional teams, had an embarrassment of riches there in that I had more product managers than I had teams, right? So I would have one product manager linked to each of the teams, and then two of them were essentially off coming up with what we were going to do next without having to worry about the day-to-day of executing against what they had dreamed up.
But you work your role into non-existence again.
Yeah. So I got the process in. I walked Agile in, built some really excellent leaders there. Since the company wasn't really expanding into new areas, in the morning I would have all of my leaders come into the office. I would say, you know, okay, worry about that. Don't worry about this. Focus here, right? We'd make a few decisions together. They would go off and I'd play bubble shooter for about 7.5 hours. And, you know, that's just only fun for so long.
So where do you move on to from there?
So from there, I went Cengage. So Cengage was interesting. It was one of the cooler titles I've ever had. Probably only cool for me because of my origin. I was the director of engineering for humanities and world languages, which included philosophy. It was an interesting arrangement in that they had all of the engineering pushed out into the content disciplines. So you had mathematics had their own engineering team. You had humanities that had its own engineering team. You know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But really what you were doing is you were taking textbook content and running it through an ETL process in order to produce online content. Since the central aspects of how you built that weren't centralized, you could never actually agree on formats or how things were stuck together and things of that nature. So after being there for a few months, I happened to coincide with when they recognized this. They wound up consolidating the engineering organization into a centralized service organization. I was given the opportunity to take a package to accept a layoff, and I went ahead and did that.
But before you did, you learned about their kind of innovative annual engineering summer party and how they funded it?
Yes. Jason, the VP, had an amazing idea one day before I joined. They funded an engineering summer party by having a golf tournament where they invited recruiters and vendors and things of that nature. They would come in, they'd play an exorbitant fee to just play golf with those of us who were directors and decision makers within Cengage. I remember it was a great day. I think it happened probably about 2, maybe 3 weeks after I joined. I'm always amused when it comes up in my Facebook feed because it's like, I love my job and it's just a picture of a fairway.
So where do you move on to after Cengage?
So after Cengage, I went to a company called EcoATM Gazelle, which at the time was owned by a company called Outerwall. Outerwall also owned companies like Coinstar and things like that. The idea was they would invest in anything that would sit around the outside of a building.
The outer wall.
The outer wall. What EcoATM Gazelle did was essentially turning around used cell phones and mobile devices. Originally, it was a ecology play where they basically just gathered all of these phones together and they would send them to other parts of the world where we were sending our e-waste, essentially. But Gazelle started to take the higher value ones of these and resell them into the consumer market. And that happened sort of right before I joined. They started to experiment with this. But I was brought into Gazelle essentially to halt the falling knife of attrition. The company had been acquired, I don't know, maybe 6 months before I joined. It didn't settle very well with most of the folks. I think they went from about 30 down to 4 or 5 when I joined in the engineering organization. We had thousands of square feet of office space, and there were like six of us in it. I remember that's when I bought my first ping putter, was a used ping pal in order to play golf in that office.
You know, I was going to suggest building a par three there.
We essentially did, because you could get all the way down to the kitchen from down the hall. So you probably had a 50-foot putt there if you really wanted to go for it. But I came in, I did that. And then, yeah, I moved on to Akamai after that, which was probably one of the bigger, more exciting, interesting roles. When I was at Tripod, there was a time when we were the seventh most trafficked site on the web, right? So right up there in the Jupyter Net ranking. That was at 15 million page views a day, right? Which at this point is a little chuckle, and it's like, oh, isn't that cute? Because what, Google does that in what, about a fifth of a second? So moving on to Akamai, where one out of every three clicks on the internet was passing through the software that my teams were responsible for, was just a step change in impact.
Now, you were here and you kind of instituted some rules around pull requests and commenting.
This is one of the first times when I recognized that what a culture is essentially game construction. So where we define culture as how we do things together, it's a set of agreements that you make with each other in order to guide your actions. And I call it a game because it works just like a game. If you've played Gin, right, there are all sorts of personal rules that come in that you need to agree to begin with, right? Otherwise, it's just no fun playing. Things like the first time you try to wrap an ace around in Gin, if somebody doesn't play that, right, now you've got an argument and everybody's, you know, a little upset. So cultures in engineering organizations are similar. And in that, there are implied agreements that need to be made explicit. Anytime you hear someone saying should is an implied agreement, right? So it's an expectation I have of you that you never agreed to uphold. So what I found at Akamai that was interesting, I had a front-end engineering team, and all of their pull requests stopped. So I started digging in, and I was seeing these comment chains that were probably 40, 50 comments long, and they were just a flame war. Now, what amused me about this is that they all sat within 6 feet of each other, and it was silent as the grave over there. So I started doing what I called group therapy. Took them all, plowed them into a conference room for a couple of hours every other day until we actually arrived at an outcome. I made it their job to build a contract that they could all honor with each other, a set of agreements. I didn't dictate the agreements. I just facilitated the conversation, and they came up with an effective group. Things like, if there are more than three comments on a pull request, stand up and have a conversation. If no one has commented on a pull request in 48 hours and you're waiting for a merge, go ahead and merge it. So getting things on clearly understood agreements and being able to use data to judge against those agreements took all of the emotional content out of the decision and allowed them to start operating with efficiency. We did lose a gentleman during this, but you know, some people don't like playing Gin either.
People don't realize a lot of the time what sort of personal ego is involved in writing software, putting it out in front of other people for review, and being able to have thick enough skin where someone makes a correction or even calls it crappy. And what are you going to do about it? It's something that my daughter's CS teacher is doing in their APCS class. And I think it's good to get in the habit of being a little bit humble early on.
100%. It's funny. And I think engineering actually is one of those spots where you get to get away with that for a lot longer because you are managing a machine and the machine doesn't have an opinion. And so you don't have to look for its perspective when you're trying to do something with it. However, with humans, each of our views of the world is constrained, myopic, very, very small, and massively inaccurate. So without the addition of other points of view next to it, you have no understanding of the world around you. You only have the stories that you're telling yourself.
So where do you go to after Akamai?
So after Akamai, I took a year off. Then I went to a company called Simply Business. Simply Business was an insurance company from the UK who decided they wanted to open up in the US market. So they focused on small businesses. So 1 to 2 employees was probably the sweet spot. But it was a very underserved market in the insurance space because your insurance brokers work on commission. And commission on a couple $1,000 policy doesn't really make a lot of sense to spend a lot of time on. So we automated that. Now, what I think was challenging about that is that unlike the UK, where you've got a single set of rules governing the insurance market, in the United States, the insurance market is regulated on a state basis. So
Going into the U.S. market means you're entering 50 markets all at once, all with different rules. One of the things I did there was to start looking at data and metrics in a really interesting way. I built a dashboard for basically team health across the entire engineering organization of, I think it was 19 or 20 different teams worldwide. And what I did was to combine, because I had a suspicion that your quantitative metrics, which I used modified Spotify style health check in order to gather the qualitative metrics, you know, things like how do people feel about their autonomy, how they feel about teamwork, code quality, all of these types of things. And I postulated that your quantitative metrics, which I was getting out of Code Climate, things like the DORA metrics, like throughput, bug rates, things of that nature, that those would oscillate in conjunction or in relationships with the qualitative metrics. So I put together a board across these 19 teams and started to track all of these metrics on a monthly basis and found some super interesting things. The one that I remember the most was around autonomy. Once you've got the metrics, you can start setting up experiments and saying, I'm going to do something for a fixed period of time, and here's what I'm going to measure because this is my hypothesis. So set up an experiment where we started giving the teams the ability to define their own roadmap and pick what they were going to work on. My suspicion was that we would see the autonomy rate go up. And if we saw the autonomy rate go up, we'd see the throughput rate go up because people are motivated to do the things they want to do. I was completely wrong. The autonomy tanked, and it tanked hard. So abandoned the experiment, thought about it a bit, and then ran the opposite experiment. What if I'd lengthen out the roadmaps that I'm handing to the teams? Right now, of course, you know, a roadmap that's 2 weeks long can be pretty accurate. One that's a month long, less so. One that's 6 months long, well,
good luck.
Good luck. But that was okay. So we started developing these longer roadmaps and giving the teams visibility into what was coming into their world, and the autonomy scores skyrocketed. So it wasn't necessarily what they were doing. It was the ability to plan their lives that seemed to drive the autonomy score. And then, of course, the throughput, things of that nature, did actually go up in conjunction with the autonomy scores, as suspected. But experiments are great when you've got data.
Now, it's here where you learn some lessons about accepting all outcomes as well.
So I was reading a lot of the Tao at that point. The idea of accepting outcomes is key, not only running teams and in the business world, but honestly, I found it first in golf. Yeah, you know, we come back to the golf thing quite a bit with me. I'm sorry. I love the game. It changes your game completely if you hit the ball into the bunker and you say, yay, now I get to hit a bunker shot. I get to try my bunker shot. And taking that as a plus instead of a, it should have been on the green, right? So the difference is, one, you're dealing with the world that exists and you're accepting it and taking all the pleasure that actually that gives you versus living in a world that doesn't exist and being upset that when you try to deal with that, nothing works out because it's make-believe. So yes, Simply Business was one of the places where you really get into this idea of stop playing make-believe. So if you're doing estimates and things of this nature, don't believe that you've got a unicorn cavalry out there to save you. Instead, just take it straight up and be very, very direct.
So after that, you move on to Rue Gilt Group?
Yes, moved on to Rue Gilt Group. It was one of those decisions you make because the market is incredibly hot. So I moved on to RGG, took over the teams that ran all of the storefront engineering. So anything that the customer sees on RGG, my teams were responsible for. Did that for, you know, a couple of years. So I was able to be the hiring manager to build out a development studio in Dublin, which was interesting.
Tell me you got to go over there and play golf.
I did not get to play golf. I did not get to play golf. However, we were right in downtown Dublin. And if anybody's been to Dublin, go check out the Ginger Man. It's a brilliant little pub. And around the holidays, it's supposed to be the most festive pub in Ireland. The lights are amazing. But went over, set up that. I think it was a few months after that. I had to sort of shepherd my team through a relatively massive layoff here in the U.S. I lost about 75% of my folks and just had to get everybody focused on what we were doing and sort of live through that. But yeah, then about a year after that, I was made redundant as well.
Out of every place you've played golf, favorite course?
That is an interesting question. You know, the one that I play a lot, it's got a soft spot in my heart, is Campbell's Highland Golf Links up in Salem, New Hampshire. There's fancy golf courses. There's, you know, not so fancy golf courses. For me, it's just, I don't know, it's the memories of playing it. What I like about Campbell's, I think, is it's fairly forgiving off of the tee for the most part. So you can score fairly well there, but it's not gimme either. So you feel good, but you also feel challenged.
Where did you perform your personal best, like a hole that maybe you birdied or like sank a 50-foot putt or that you'll never forget?
I'll give you two stories on this one. So one,
I was playing Wyndham, coming around to the 18th. It's getting dark, and I'm playing with a buddy of mine. Terrible off the tee, terrible second shot. So I'm lying probably about 160 yards out, something like that. Take out my 7-iron. This is years ago. I hit my 7-iron much longer now. And I land one within about a foot of the pin. And you've got everybody out there having their beers after the round up at the 19th hole, got all the claps and all that, right? Of course, nobody knew that I was lying like 7. You know, but what a great shot. But the last round I played at Merrimack, right in Methuen, it's right down the street from my house, actually. The back nine, wow, it just worked for me. I shot a 4-under,
wow,
which I've never come close to that in my life. I shot a 74 for the round, which was my personal best. And that the 4-under, I actually parred both of the par fives on that, but I drove two of the greens on the par fours.
Wow.
It was a good nine. It was a very good nine.
That is a good back nine. Tell me quickly, if you could, a bit about the Great Dog Rescue of New England.
Yes, a great cause. So both of my pups are from Great Dog. They're local here in Woburn. Yeah, great organization, lots of great people. Check them out if you're looking for your next companion. They'll always accept donations of, you know, food and money and things of that nature as well. So
Mac, thank you so much for joining us and sharing your experiences with the listeners of Underserved.
Well, thanks for having me. It's been a lot of fun. You know, these days working from home and whatnot, I spend a lot of time with my pups. It's nice to talk to other humans.
Absolutely. And we'll talk to everyone soon on the next episode of Underserved.
Thank you for listening to the Underserved podcast. For more information on the topics discussed and for show notes, visit the show website, underserved.fm. And please be sure to rate, like, and subscribe to Underserved on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.